From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The film Little Miss Sunshine has been an audience favorite, a critics favorite, and now is nominated for 4 Academy Awards, including Best Picture and Best Original Screenplay. And no one could be more surprised at this success than the team who made the film. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with the film's directors, Valerie Faris and Jonathan Dayton, and the screenwriter, Michael Arndt. Also, Rottles, Puggles, and Labradoodles, we talk with John Moalem about designer dogs, new breeds created for specific temperaments and physical characteristics. It's the subject of his cover story in yesterday's New York Times Magazine. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The movie Little Miss Sunshine has gotten the reaction every independent filmmaker dreams of. When it was shown at Sundance 1 year ago, it didn't even have a distributor. Now it's a big hit and has 4 Oscar nominations, Best Picture, Best Screenplay, and Best Supporting Actor and Actress. My guests are the screenwriter, Michael Arndt, this is his first film, and the film's 2 directors, Valerie Faris and Jonathan Dayton, who are married. Faris and Dayton have made many music videos and TV commercials and 1 music documentary. Little Miss Sunshine is a kind of road trip movie in which a dysfunctional family in a dysfunctional VW bus travels to a children's beauty pageant that their daughter Olive has entered. Here's a scene from the beginning of the film. The whole family is sitting around the dinner table. Olive and her teenage brother, played by Abigail Breslin and Paul Dano, their parents, played by Greg Kinnear and Toni Collette, their grandfather, played by Alan Arkin, and their uncle, played by Steve Carell. The uncle has come to live with the family after his failed suicide attempt. Olive wants to know why her uncle was just in the hospital.
How did it happen?
How did what happen?
Your accident.
Hi. Here.
Oh, no. It's okay. Unless you object.
Oh. No, I'm pro-honesty here. I just think, you know, it's up to you.
Be my guest.
Olive, Uncle Frank didn't really have an accident. What happened was he tried to kill himself.
You did? Why?
I'm sorry. I don't think this is an appropriate conversation. Honey, let's let Uncle Frank finish his dinner, okay? Shh.
Why did you want to kill yourself?
No, don't answer the question, Frank.
Richard.
Don't answer it.
Richard.
He's not going to answer the question, Frank.
I wanted to kill myself.
Don't listen to him.
Richard.
I was
he's
very
he's
unhappy.
A sick man. He's a sick in his head man.
Richard.
I'm sorry. I don't think it's an appropriate conversation for a 7-year-old.
Well, she's going to find out anyway.
Oh, okay.
Go on, Frank.
Why were you unhappy?
Well, there were a lot of reasons. Mainly, though, I fell in love with someone who didn't love me back.
Who?
One of my grad students. I was very much in love with him.
Him? It was a boy? You fell in love with the boy?
Yes, I did. Very much so.
That's silly.
You're right. It was silly. It was very, very silly.
There's another word for it.
Dad.
Michael, you wrote Little Miss Sunshine. What was the first part of the story that came to you?
Well, the first part of the story was, it was actually the ending, because I had, you know, tried writing a couple of other scripts, and they had ended sort of badly. They had ended with everybody getting killed at the end, and they were just big downers. And I decided, you know, nobody wants to watch a movie, you know, that's such a huge downer. And I decided the next script that I was going to write was going to have an ending that would just be unbelievably wonderful. So I was really just looking for a great ending. I was looking for something that would just wildly exceed your expectations. And I remember I was just sitting and watching, you know, clips of a child beauty pageant on TV, and there were all these little skinny blonde girls up there. And I just thought to myself, you know, wouldn't it be great if a little chubby girl got up there and you thought it was going to be this total disaster? You thought she'd be, you know, just humiliated. But instead, she just, you know, started dancing and rocked the house and blew everybody away. And I was pretty sure that that would be a good ending. So, having, you know, found my ending, it was really a matter of sort of reverse engineering the story and figuring out, you know, who is this little girl? What is this pageant that she's at? Who is her family? How does she get there?
Who is her family? You came up with some really interesting answers to that question. So I'm going to ask you to say a couple of words about, like, a few short words about a couple of the characters. Let's start with the girl's father, played by Greg Kinnear. He's a guy trying to sell his motivational self-help plan, Refuse to Lose.
Right,
but he can't even succeed in finding a publisher.
Yeah, he's really sort of the main satirical target of the movie. I just thought, you know, it was actually in a phone call with my brother, and I was just talking about how, you know, the funny thing about families is that they can be related to each other by blood, but otherwise have nothing in common with each other. And I just started riffing with my brother about, you know, wouldn't it be funny if there was a family and, like, the dad was this failed motivational speaker, and, you know, you had this uncle who was this highbrow academic, and, you know, the dad was this, the grandfather was this sort of profane, you know, say anything kind of guy. And, you know, I was just making up these characters, and that those two ideas really connected. It was the little girl, you know, wanting to be a beauty queen, and then this crazy family, you know, that was going to, you know, be put, you know, sent on a road trip.
One more character I'm going to ask you about, and this is the character played by Steve Carell. He's the uncle of the girl who wants to be in the beauty pageant, and he's moved in with his family because after his suicide attempt, the doctors think it's unsafe for him to be alone. So tell us about the inspiration for this character.
Well, my brother's an academic. I have two brothers, actually, who are professors. And the world of academia is, to me, just sort of an inherently sort of amusing place because it is very removed to a degree from the real world. And, you know, there's the old joke that the fights in academia are especially bitter because the stakes are so low. And I just thought that he was a great counterpoint. You know, Richard Hoover, the dad, is this sort of lowbrow version of self-improvement, and Uncle Frank really is his sort of highbrow counterpart. I mean, he is an aspirational figure also, but I just thought the tension between sort of lowbrow and highbrow would be very funny. And then in terms of making it being Proust, I remember my brother, who is a professor.
We mention that he sees himself as America's foremost Proust scholar?
Yeah, he's the number one Proust scholar in America, exactly. My brother teaches Proust. He's a literature professor, and we were talking on the phone, and he mentioned this little thing that Proust has at the end of In Search of Lost Time, that the happy years are the wasted years, and the years that are most valuable in your life are the ones in which you're unhappy. And I thought that was such a great thing to have that character say, especially to Dwayne at the end of the movie, that I thought, well, the only way you're going to buy it coming out of his mouth would be to make him, you know, an expert in Proust.
Well, Jonathan Dayton, Valerie Faris, how did you get a hold of Michael's screenplay for Little Miss Sunshine?
We have two producers that we've known for a while, Albert Berger and Ron Yerkes, gave us the script. And actually, when they gave it to us, they said, you know, it's about a family, a dysfunctional family that goes on a road trip to take their daughter to a child beauty pageant. And when we heard that description, we thought, I don't really think that's something we'd want to do, you know. So we didn't actually read it right away.
But then I remember Val picked it up and was reading it in the other room, and I heard her laughing.
Which never happens.
Yeah. To anyone when they usually read a screenplay, particularly Val. And so I read it, and she kind of kept quiet, and we both just loved it. And
I remember Jonathan in the other room reading it and laughing out loud. So, I mean, it really was just the first time we had read a script where we felt like we had to make the movie. There was no choice. We were so in love with it. I mean, we just hadn't read anything that we liked so much.
Well, you put your finger on a problem. You know, the movie was described to you as like a road trip movie about a dysfunctional family headed to a beauty pageant. And you didn't think you wanted to make that movie. So, Michael, let me ask you, how do you wish the movie had been initially described to them?
Yeah, no, I it was a problem from the very beginning for me. I always thought that this was the least marketable film of all time. And I actually, you know, I had the story in my head for years and years and just sort of carried it around and didn't do anything with it just because I thought it was such a small movie and such a sort of nothing sort of unsexy premise. And I thought, you know, who's going to want to sit in a VW bus and watch this family bicker with each other? But I finally, you know, I finally just decided, well, I'm going to write this just to get it out of my head. You know, I'd spent time working as a script reader, so I'd read hundreds and hundreds of screenplays. And I was very determined that by the time that I sent the script out, it would feel finished. It would feel like a real movie because as a reader, that's the rarest thing to happen is you read a script, you turn the last page, and you say, I see that movie. So I'm very, very glad that Jonathan and Valerie had that reaction.
Did you do anything on the first page to make sure that people read to page 2, 3, 4, and 5, since you'd been a reader and you probably put down a lot of scripts after the first page?
I think that a mistake that a lot of comedies make, and I saw this over and over again, is that they try to be funny right away. I know it sounds sort of like a contradiction, but I think the problem with most comedies is that they're not serious enough. And if you start high on a comedy, if you have Mr. Wacky wake up and, you know, he goes to his wacky job and he meets his wacky girlfriend and all these wacky things happen, you sort of don't have anywhere else to go from there. You can't go, you know, if you start high, you can't go up. So I was really determined, you know, to introduce each of these, start very low, very quiet, very subdued, and introduce each of these characters one at a time, and just, you know, hopefully, in the first 10 pages, just get you to buy the reality of the situation. I think that's something that most scripts don't spend enough time doing is just setting up the world, having you enter into this world and sort of explore it and just buy the reality of the situation. So I actually held off, you know, for the first 10 or 15 pages on a lot of the comedy and let it, you know, let the readers or let the audience get to know the characters first and then start mining the interactions of the characters for humor. So
in directing the film, did you contribute any of your own dysfunctional family moments to the story?
Well, it's funny. Not, I mean, the script was so well realized that it, you know, it was not so much adding things in the script, but I think just
relating to it.
Yeah, I mean, we have three children. You know, it took us a long time to get the film made, and there were so many times along the way where we'd go, oh my God, this is a Little Miss Sunshine moment.
Yeah, like one of our kids would have a fit and run out of the van, our van, and refuse to get back in the car, and we'd be late for school, and you know, we were so tired of feeling like, God, we're living this script, but when do we get the chance to make it?
Did you go to beauty pageants to see what they're like from the inside?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it was very important to us to not make fun of the pageant world, that, you know, we went to these pageants and we wanted to make sure that they were accurate and ideally, and we were able to achieve this, we were able to cast real pageant kids in the film. So everyone you see in the movie is from the pageant world, and most of them are doing their own acts, you know,
their own hair and makeup, yeah, and they've got their own costumes.
It was a low-budget movie, so it was great to be able to get, you know, these acts ready to go.
What about their mothers? Were their mothers real?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was a package deal. And, you know, I mean, also, the thing is that, you know, initially there was a desire to shoot this film in Canada, and we really fought that because the Canadians, to their credit, don't have a kid pageant scene. And you know, pageant kids start training at 6 months often. And they, you know, so when they're, by the time they're 8 or 9, you know, they've been doing this for, you know, many years. And you can't teach a kid who doesn't know this world how to move like that. And how to, for that matter, how to grow, you know, these girls have been growing their hair so that it can get in those big shapes, and it's just not something that can be done, you know, quickly.
Valerie, was there ever a moment when you were young, when you dreamed of being Miss America or something, that helped you, like, relate to the character of Olivia in the movie who wants to be in the beauty pageant?
You mean Olive.
Olive, dude, I mean Olive, dude, yes, yeah. Thank you.
That's the French version, or yeah. I don't know. I never dreamed of being Miss America or really in a beauty pageant, but the one thing that I did relate to about the character of Olive was when she's doing her dance. I remember when I was like 6 years old and running around in my living room and my parents sitting on the couch watching me, and I probably was just, you know, running through the room and jumping in the air and doing spins, but I remember thinking that I was doing this magnificent dance, and I think that's, I totally related to that age where you still have the fantasy in your head of what you're doing, and it's not, you know, it doesn't really matter what you're actually doing. It's the feeling you have as you're doing it, and that she believed that she was great and that she was a great dancer, and I just loved that she still had that fantasy life, and you know.
I think that's what the other members of the family want to protect too, is that they see that this is something that means so much to her, and whether she's great at it or not, it's something that she feels so passionately about. And many of the family members have all lost something that has meant something to them. So, you know, she is this last stand, you know.
And I think I have to say in the movie, I think that Abigail Breslin does such a good job of showing the sort of dawning consciousness that Olive has, you know, that she starts out very innocent and she starts out thinking that she's going to be great and she's so happy she won and she's going to go to this contest and hopefully win. And in the course of the movie, you see, you know, this little 8-year-old girl, you know, start to look at herself the way other people look at her. And it is this sort of very melancholy transition this character makes. And I just think Abigail as an actress just captured that so, so perfectly.
We'll talk more with the directors and screenwriter of Little Miss Sunshine after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about Little Miss Sunshine with the film's screenwriter Michael Arndt and directors Jonathan Dayton and Valerie Faris. Here's another scene from the film. The whole family is in the car, driving daughter Olive to her beauty pageant. Richard, played by Greg Kinnear, is telling his brother-in-law, Frank, played by Steve Carell, about his plan to get his self-help book published.
So finally, I'm just sitting there, and I decide, you know, this is Stan Grossman. What the hell? And I start pitching him the 9 steps, and about, I don't know, 2 minutes in, he stops me. He says, I can sell this.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah, and this is the guy who knows how to do it, you know? You start with a book, and then you do a media tour, corporate events, DVD, VHS series. I mean, there's a whole fascinating science into how you roll these things out.
Wow.
Yeah, so he's in Scottsdale right now, you know, building the buzz and kind of getting the whole hype thing going. He's doing what the pros call a ticking clock auction.
Oh, how about that?
Yeah, and I can detect that note of sarcasm there, Frank.
What sarcasm? I didn't hear.
But I want you to know something. I feel sorry for you.
You do? Good.
Yeah, I do. Because sarcasm is the refuge of losers.
It is? Really?
Yep. Sarcasm is losers trying to bring winners down to their level, and that's step 4 in the program.
Wow, Richard, you really opened my eyes to what a loser I am. How much do I owe you for those pearls of
wisdom? Oh, that one's on the house, buddy.
It is?
Yeah, it's on the house.
Guys,
that's on the house.
Wow. Hey, guys,
that was for free.
No charge.
Stop. You're not going to charge.
Stop it.
There's a scene in the movie where, you know, like they're on this like long trip in their VW bus, like the whole family getting the girl to the beauty pageant, and because of all the mishaps they have along the way, they're really late. But, you know, although this is a road trip movie in some ways, the car is dysfunctional too. It's not just the people, it's the car.
Right,
and,
right, right.
And it, you know, it's a VW van, a VW bus, and because the clutch is broken, they have to, like, push it into second gear in order to get it started. And this is the kind of scene that would seem really, like, silly and improbable to me had it not been for the fact that I, many years ago, made several trips in a van that had exactly the same problem.
you actually
had to run and push it and then pop it into second gear.
Right, right.
And so I guess I just found it interesting that something that would have struck me as completely improbable, I actually witnessed firsthand. So Michael, can you talk about coming up with the idea for this kind of van, you know, for a van with that problem?
Yeah, it was very easy actually to come up with the that idea because my family had a VW van when I was a kid, and pretty much everything that happens in the movie happened to our van. So it was the door coming off, the horn getting stuck. We actually had the wheel come off, you know, while we were driving, which was in the script. It didn't quite make it into the movie. And then, of course, having the clutch give out. And we actually, you know, my family and I drove 600 miles in a VW bus with a broken clutch, and we had to, you know, just push it every time to get it started. It could start up in third gear, and then my dad was able to shift into fourth without using the clutch. So it was, people ask me, you know, is the movie autobiographical? And I say, well, the only thing that's really autobiographical is the car.
Abigail Breslin, the young actress who plays Olive in the movie, was nominated for a Golden Globe and is now nominated for a Supporting Actress Award for an Oscar. How did you find her? It must be very difficult to cast a child in a role because, first of all, they don't have the kind of experience, and they haven't made that many movies. At least I assume she hadn't. Second of all, I don't know if the audition process is as easy to do or as easy to interpret for you as it would be for the process auditioning an adult.
Well, yeah, I mean, after reading the script, our first concern was how do we find Olive? Because if you don't have a credible Olive, you just don't have a movie. So the first thing we did was get seed money to start the search, and we actually looked in every English-speaking country in the world. I mean, we did casting sessions in Australia and in the UK and across America, and we found only one person who we thought could do it, and it was Abigail. And at the time, she was 6 years old, but it took so long to get the movie made that she actually sort of grew to an ideal age when we eventually shot the movie.
But even at six, her audition was pretty incredible. I mean, she had these lines. At 6 years old, she seemed to understand the scene with Grandpa. She really, you know, she did it great at that age. But I think, you know, the thing with Abigail, she had, by the time we worked with her, she was nine, and she'd already done, I think, four movies. So she also had more experience making movies than we did. And she just was, you know, I think that does make a difference so that they're not kind of shell-shocked when they get onto the set. And, you know, she, if you we watched her other films and we watched her appearances on the Jay Leno show, and that was in some ways what completely sold us on her, was watching her with Jay Leno, because she sat on that show and instead of kind of playing to the audience, she was completely engaged in her conversation with Leno. And I think that's what's sort of exceptional about her, is that she's an incredible listener. And, you know, even if she's not talking in a scene, she's completely engaged. And that's pretty rare for a kid.
We'll talk more with the directors and the screenwriter of Little Miss Sunshine in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble. With the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Harriet Jacobs's Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl, in stores and online at bn.com. And from the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, what do you get when you breed a pug and a beagle? A puggle. Or a Rottweiler and a poodle? A rottle. We talk with John Mowallam about the new designer dogs. It's the subject of his cover story from yesterday's New York Times Magazine. Also, more of our interview with the team behind the film Little Miss Sunshine. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with the team that made Little Miss Sunshine, screenwriter Michael Arndt and directors Valerie Faris and Jonathan Dayton, who are married to each other. Little Miss Sunshine is nominated for 4 Oscars, Best Picture, Best Screenplay, Best Supporting Actor, and Best Supporting Actress. It took years for Little Miss Sunshine to get made. Why was it so difficult?
Well, I mean, there were many reasons. I think, as we talked about earlier, it's a hard film to describe. And I think anytime people go to make a movie, they immediately start thinking about, well, how are we going to sell this? And, you know, how can it be simplified, you know, to a tagline or a poster?
Or a star vehicle, you know.
Yeah. And because it was a true ensemble film, you know, studios tend to be nervous about ensemble pictures because they can't put the face of one star or two stars on the poster. And you know, in the past, ensemble films haven't sold so well. So there were a lot of strikes against it. And then I think, finally, you know, the whole notion of a dysfunctional family comedy was something that I think people felt was tired. Now, I think if people look closely, obviously this was a fresh treatment of that subject. But on the surface, it felt like territory we'd all been through.
And I think also at the same time, it's what they call in Hollywood an execution-dependent film, which means that it really had to, you know, you really had to sort of thread the needle or hit the bullseye for it to really work. And if you had had, you know, just one weak link in the chain, like if you had miscast Olive, for example, you know, or if you had shot poorly the final dance number, then the whole movie wouldn't work. It would have been a disaster. So I think people were just always nervous about the fact that, you know, I was a first-time writer, John Novell were first-time directors, and sort of, you know, was this really, you know, people tended to really like the script, but, you know, there was always the question was, you know, was that going to be able to translate onto the screen?
Steve Carell wasn't that well known yet when you cast him in the movie. It was before 40-Year-Old Virgin was released. Did the ability to get a good distributor or to raise money for the film change when he became more famous?
It certainly didn't hurt us. but it's funny because I think when we cast him, he was probably the one that, you know, everyone was sort of, he was the biggest question mark in a way, although we didn't feel that because we met him. We'd seen a couple episodes of The Office. It hadn't started airing yet, but we saw him in The Office. We've loved his work and all the films that he's done and on the Jon Stewart show. So, and then meeting him, we just thought he gets this character so thoroughly, and we agreed in kind of the way we were going to approach the film. So we felt totally confident with him, but I think in some ways he may have been considered the biggest risk we were taking.
But the film, you know, we had finished shooting the film when The 40-Year-Old Virgin came out, and it wasn't really till Sundance and where the film was offered for sale that Steve's, rising star really came in handy.
I remember Steve on the set, he would come, you know, to act on the set, but then he would say, oh, we had a test screening of The 40-Year-Old Virgin last night, and you know, I really think it went well, but I shouldn't say that. You know, he's such a modest guy, but, we were hearing, you know, that he was getting great scores.
Jonathan, Valerie, you're a husband and wife, and you're a directing team, so how did you maintain your sense of unity to the actors when making the movie? Did they talk with both of you each time they had a question, or did you say, well, let me get back to my spouse and then, or my co-director, and then we'll get back to you as a team and give you the answer?
Well, it happened so many different ways, but you know, we had 3 years to prepare for this. We actually workshopped 5 different scenes from the movie and with other actors, and so we had seen parts of the film up and running. So we had a pretty good understanding of what we wanted. We even acted out some of the scenes in our garage with just the two of us so that we knew what we were asking of the actors. We weren't performing very well, but we at least knew the feelings that we were going for. So many times we had talked about so much that we knew what
the other one would say.
Yeah, we knew the collective stand on most issues. But you know, there were probably some times where we'd say, "Well, let me just talk to Valerie, and we'll come back to you." Or, you know, usually,
or we'd both be there. I mean, a lot of times when there's something, you know, really important, or there's something that you're trying to work out, the two of us would be there with the actor, and then it would be a discussion among the three of us. So, it's funny how rarely that does come up where somebody says, you know, what about this? And then one of us has to go and check with the other.
Yeah.
It's very organic, and I don't really know exactly how it works or how to describe it, except that we've never had anybody on the set say, you know, I can't talk to two directors. Not yet, anyway.
Just one more question, Jonathan and Valerie. Which came first for you, being a directorial team or being a couple?
You want to guess?
Do we want to guess? No, I'm going to let you answer it.
No. Yeah.
Well, it's funny because we think that that's probably the secret behind why we work so well together, is that we worked together for 6 years and then we started dating. So, you know, all the work habits were already established and we had respect for each other, which is a good way to start.
And we still do.
Yeah, we still do. But so many people say to us, I don't know how you work with your spouse. You know, my husband or my wife and I could never work together. And it's kind of funny to me because I think, well, how do you raise kids together? Or how do you live together? It almost sounds like you don't like each other. So you know, we happen to like each other as well as respect each other.
Well, I want to congratulate all of you for the success of Little Miss Sunshine and for the Academy Award Best Picture nomination. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Great to talk to you.
Thanks.
Jonathan Dayton and Valerie Faris directed Little Miss Sunshine. Michael Arndt wrote the screenplay. The film is nominated for 4 Oscars, including Best Picture and Best Screenplay. Coming up, Labradoodles, Puggles, and Cockapoos, we talk about the new designer dogs. This is Fresh Air. You can get custom tiles for your kitchen or custom colors for your family room. Now journalist John Mo Allam reports Americans willing to pay for it are getting custom-made pets. Mo Allam's piece in Sunday's New York Times Magazine focuses on designer dogs like the Labradoodle, born of a Labrador and poodle, or the Puggle. Want to guess? That's a pug and a beagle. Mo Allam finds the trend is drawing criticism from dog-breeding traditionalists and raising questions about our relationship with man's best friend. John Mo Allam is a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. His pieces have also appeared in Harper's, The Nation, and Salon.com. Last Friday, when Dave Davies was hosting Fresh Air, he recorded this interview with Mo Allam.
Well, John Mo Allam, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
You write in this piece that designer dogs became popular about a decade ago. What exactly is a designer dog?
Well, you know, a designer dog is really a lot of things to a lot of different people. When I said that it really became popular a decade ago, you know, that's really talking about a dog called the Labradoodle, which is, you know, in this country is largely a crossbred dog of a purebred Labrador Retriever and a purebred poodle. You put those two dogs together and the litter of puppies you get are Labradoodles. And that's sort of the way it's gone on with people crossing different dogs, purebred to purebred, and then just sort of mashing the two breed names together and coming up with you know, a kind of cute label for it, like a Maltipoo, which would be a Maltese and a poodle, or a Puggle, which would be a pug and a beagle. And it's just sort of gone on exponentially from there in kind of this free-for-all of people combining these different breeds.
You know, it takes some effort to do this. What were the breeders trying to accomplish?
Well, the first people to do a Labradoodle, actually, this happened in Australia in the 80s. And as I understand it, the breeder who did, you know, the first quote-unquote Labradoodle was working to breed a dog that would be a guide dog for the blind, but would also work for a particular woman with very bad allergies. So he actually took hair samples from different dogs, I think mostly poodles, trying to find a sample that this woman's allergies could tolerate. And, you know, when he found a couple that seemed workable, he then bred that one of those dogs to a Labrador, which is, you know, typically one of the dogs used as guide dogs. But what happened in Australia was that other breeders picked up on this and they sort of tried to build an actual breed of dog that was the Labradoodle. And the way you do that is you take that first litter of hybrid puppies of poodle crossed with Labrador, and then you pick out the ones that you like. You look for whatever traits you want, either the temperament or the particular kind of coat, and you start breeding them together. Maybe you'll breed one to another breed of dog, kind of tweaking what you see in each generation. And as you go down the line, eventually, you know, as you're inbreeding and bringing in new breeds and just kind of honing the subsequent generations, you end up with a line that breeds true. And that means that you'll be able to take two Labradoodles, put them together, have them have a litter of puppies, and those puppies will really have those traits that you've been trying to fix in the line.
And so at that point, you have no longer a hybrid. You have a new breed, right?
Right. And people are doing this all the time. I mean, there's breeders who are, you know, constantly founding new breeds. But this has been going on really since the late 1800s when people started, you know, really seriously breeding what we now think of as purebred dogs. But what happened with the Labradoodle, though, was was the Australian breeders who had done this then started exporting those dogs to the U.S. As pets. You know, here they had a dog with what they felt was a great friendly temperament. It was a relatively non-shedding dog, so it didn't make much of a mess. It was good with people with allergies. And they'd put all this hard work into it, you know, over about a decade of getting these dogs just the way they wanted them, that they, you know, put a price tag on it of $2,000 or $3,000, and people started buying them here. You know, in some ways, it was kind of a big misunderstanding how the designer dog craze started in this country, because what happened was, you know, American breeders, people who were breeding purebred dogs, you know, for pet stores or selling them directly through the internet, suddenly saw this thing called the Labradoodle. It cost $2,500. It seemed obvious how you made one. It was right there in the name. You took a Labrador and a poodle, and people kind of misunderstood that's all it was. That's all the Australians had done. So they would, you know, take their Labrador, maybe go next door to their friend who had a poodle, breed a Labradoodle, and try to sell it for $2,500, $3,000. And it worked. It largely worked.
What were some other combinations that you found interesting or intriguing?
Well, you know, some of the most interesting combinations are the ones that seem like two really different dogs. I met one man in Denver who had actually never bred dogs before. And he was just looking to get himself a pet. And he ended up breeding a poodle to a Rottweiler. And he called it a Rottle, a standard poodle on a Rottweiler. And, you know, this is a guy, he worked for the post office. He really had no experience breeding dogs. And over about 5 or 6 years of visiting breeders and trying to find what he would consider to be the perfect pet, and sort of being very disillusioned by the whole, you know, culture of the show dogs and show breeders, just decided that he would read up over a period of years. He dug deep into the interlibrary loan program of the Denver Public Library, came up with some really interesting reading and talked to people, and ended up crossing these two dogs. And you know, honestly, when I looked at the dog, I couldn't really tell that there were any specks of poodle or Rottweiler in it. It was really its own thing. It sort of goes to show you that you can't really tell what a dog is going to turn out like until you do that first cross.
And did the Rottle, is that what we call it, did it have behavioral characteristics? I mean, did the guy get what he was looking for?
Yeah, I think he did. He was really looking for, you know, ironically, because he was working for the post office, he really was looking for a really confident guard dog, which I'm sure angered a lot of his colleagues at the Postal Service. But he did. He felt that, and I met some of the puppies. I mean, it's hard to tell only spending an afternoon with the dogs. But he did feel, out of the 10 puppies that he had seen, you know, a very trainable dog with some of the qualities of the poodle, with also some of the confidence of the Rottweiler. I think it's really important to point out that so much of this is subjective, and that's, you know, something I get at in the piece, is that I really think ultimately a lot of the appeal of these dogs is almost kind of a Rorschach-like quality to them. You know, here's this thing, we've given it a name, we don't quite know what it is yet, it doesn't have a reputation, and we're free to see what we want to see in it. If we want to see, you know, the temperament of a poodle, you know, oh, I knew a poodle once and it was sweet, and this dog is sweet, so that must have come from the poodle. You know, we're free to do that. The scientific reality of it, you know, is far more complicated, and so much of it has to do with the individuals who are breeding the dogs themselves and their scrupulousness, their good taste in terms of selecting, you know, high-quality parents, screening for health problems, screening for behavior. You know, so much of what a dog turns out like is dependent on the whims and the practices of the people breeding it, that it's almost a bit of a red herring to say that, you know, to give these breeds or designer dogs names and assume that, you know, all Puggles will be the same, or, you know, all Pugs or all Beagles will be the same for that matter.
You know, some of these breeds that are being combined are pretty different. I mean, we picture the Rottweiler and the Poodle. Does the breeding occur naturally in these animals, or is artificial insemination frequently needed?
Right. Well, in most of, I would assume in all, and certainly in the vast majority of the designer dogs, the dogs are breeding naturally. The trick, so to speak, is to use the larger dog as the mother. if you do that, then you'll be able to have the dogs, you know, manage the procreation on their own, and then but more importantly, you'll have the puppies in the womb adapt to the size of the mother, so that generally you'll have a size and shape of puppy that can fit through the mother's birth canal.
Right.
Where you run into issues with artificial insemination or C-sections is with purebred dogs. There are many breeds of purebred that can no longer procreate on their own reliably without human intervention, or that have to have virtually all of their puppies delivered by C-section because the puppies just can't cram down the birth canal. It's too narrow at this point.
And that's because the breeding over the centuries has exaggerated their physical features such they just can't do nature's tricks anymore.
That's right. Breeders have latched on to a certain description of the dog, a certain vision of what the perfect dog of each breed would look like, and over 150 or 100 years of selecting for that shape and those proportions, they've really exaggerated a lot of those qualities. They've really come up with some kind of more dramatic geometries of dogs, and it does get to a point where they can no longer do their only biological function.
And which breeds are most misshapen this way?
Well, it's my understanding that it's a lot of the smaller breeds that where you find examples of this. I know, for example, the pug is a great example of a dog that, the quote unquote best bred pugs, the pugs that look most like the ideal description of a pug, can no longer reliably mate on their own, and pug puppies are virtually always delivered by C-section.
Wow! So pugs in the wild would simply not reproduce.
Yeah. Right, they'll never be feral pugs. This was what one pug fancier told me.
So there are thousands of dog cesarean sections every year?
Yeah, there are, and there's also elaborate surgical procedures for inseminating dogs. The most dramatic being, I guess, that you can actually open up the dog, inject semen directly into the reproductive system of the mother. Replace it all and sew it back up, and that's sort of your surest bet to make sure that you're going to have puppies. Also, because oftentimes you're paying $500, $600, $700 in a stud fee. You're basically buying the semen of someone else's male dog, and you want to make sure when you do that you're giving yourself the best shot of having a litter of puppies.
We'll hear more about the new designer dogs when Dave Davies continues his interview with journalist John Mo'Allam, that is, after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to the interview that Fresh Air's frequent guest host Dave Davies recorded with journalist John Mo'Allam about the new designer dogs. Mo'Allam's article on designer dogs was the cover story of this week's New York Times Magazine.
I was intrigued that one of the breeders that you spoke to, Wallace Havens, had worked out multi-generational formulas for combining 5 or 6 different breeds. He would give them names which didn't disclose which 5 or 6 breeds they were. what was he up to?
Wallace is a guy who is generally credited as quote-unquote inventing the Puggle, which was one of the more popular designer dogs. It kind of peaked about a year and a half ago or so. He really felt like he had invented this thing. He'd been breeding Puggles for about 20 years. And what happened was, as soon as in about the winter of 2005, celebrities started having Puggles and being photographed with them, Jake Gyllenhaal went on I think it was the Ellen DeGeneres show with a Puggle, And it sort of spiked the Puggles' popularity. And, you know, breeding a Puggle or something that you can call a Puggle is not terribly difficult if you have a Pug and a Beagle around. And what happened was lots of people jumped on this bandwagon and started breeding Puggles and selling them over the internet. There are now, with one small registry service alone, there are something like 200 Puggle breeders on file. One of every four litters they register a month is Puggles.
Wow.
And Wallace really felt, I think he felt a little hurt about this. I think he felt like he didn't respect the quality of the Puggles that were being bred. He felt like he bred them in a far better way. He had told me that he'd seen people breeding pugs to other kinds of hound dogs and calling them Puggles. He actually said something like it was giving the Puggle a bad name. And I think these kind of multi-generational crosses that he started in on are a kind of way to stay ahead of the game.
Are breeders regulated at all? Is there any state or federal agency that looks after breeders?
There is in some cases. In terms of on a national scale, there's the USDA. And my understanding is that the USDA is only inspecting people who are selling their dogs not directly to the public, so to pet stores or any other middleman type of situation. You know, if I wanted to breed a few dogs in my backyard and then put up an ad on the internet, as far as I know, I would be more or less immune to any kind of regulation or inspection.
I just have to ask you about a couple of more of these clever combinations. There, one of them you mentioned was the Sharpeys and the Bassets being combined for Sharp Assets. Is that anything more than a word game?
You know, it is easy to ask the question whether you know, the name comes first in a lot of situations. And it seems like, you know, the quirkier the name, the more attention it's going to get to start with, regardless of what the dog itself is like.
Well, I'm sure there's some controversy and issues around this designer dog trend. And, you know, it occurred to me that part of the appeal of owning a dog is having a little piece of the natural world in our lives, this creature with its own wants and instincts that you can't change. And to some people, it would seem sort of creepy to be kind of genetically modifying that.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting to what degree the criticisms and the worries and concerns about this are related to the dogs and to the extent that they're related to the people who should be responsible for the dogs. You know, in terms of manipulating dogs themselves, you know, we've been doing that for tens of thousands of years. The name designer dog, in my mind, is a bit of a misnomer because it's not clear to what extent any of these dogs are really being designed for, you know, specific goals in mind, which is not to say that those dogs are you know, bad or poorly bred animals. But, you know, a lot of the purebred dogs were really just as much of a manipulation of nature. You know, the line between what is natural and what is unnatural in the domestic dog is pretty hazy, if not non-existent altogether. In the Victorian era, when a lot of the purebred dog fancy, as it's called, the people who breed dogs competitively for show, started. You know, they were taking sort of existing breeds of dogs and they were crossing them and then inbreeding them and introducing other breeds to get just what they wanted. That to me is you know, every bit as much, if not more, of a design practice.
Is the interest of pet owners in designer dogs related at all to changes in modern lifestyle? I mean, a lot of people who are very, very busy like cats because they're lower maintenance. Are people looking for dogs that they can treat more like cats?
Yeah, I mean, that's essentially what some people told me who I interviewed for the article. What happened in the 80s was that for the first time in America, pet cats were more popular than pet dogs. There were more pet cats. And, you know, when I asked one man, a guy named Bob Viteri, who's the president of a pet products trade group about this, he basically, you know, put it right back to scoopable litter. He said that was the real clincher, that suddenly a cat, which was something that was seen as self-sufficient, you know, was now even more self-sufficient. We didn't really have to muss around with a smelly litter box as often. And you do see, you know, in the past 20 years, a lot of products that have come out that are basically designed to give a dog the best life possible without us having to change our lifestyle so much.
Like what?
So, you know, if we want to leave the dog... Sure. If we want to leave the dog at home, but we don't want it to get on our furniture, there are, you know, tons of products, everything to these sort of mildly electrified little mats that you can set up like a little minefield around your living room. So you do see, to me, this just sort of shows that there is this subtle dissatisfaction with having to make a compromise with your dog. I don't think that there's any reason to believe that, a Cockapoo or a Labradoodle or any of the new breeds is going to make that tremendously easier, if at all. But certainly when there's a new dog there, I think people are very optimistic and they say, well, maybe this is it. Maybe this is finally the perfect dog, the one I've been looking for.
Well, John Moalem, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
John Moalem wrote this week's New York Times Magazine cover story about the new designer dogs. He spoke with Dave Davies, who guest hosts Fresh Air and is a senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News. We'll have pictures of the new designer dogs on our website, freshair.npr.org. And now you can also go to our website for podcasts of Fresh Air. That's freshair.npr.org. I'm Terry Gross.
Getting a pretty little poodle dog. Got a face just like a frog. Oh, my pretty little poodle doodle doodle doodle. Pretty little poodle doodle dog. He's my pretty little poodle dog. Got a face just like a frog. Oh, my pretty little poodle doodle doodle doodle. Pretty little poodle doodle dog. I fell in love with a rooster once.
Support for NPR comes from the Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities. On the web at WKKF.org. From Bantam Books, publisher of Adopted Son, a story of Washington, Lafayette, and the friendship that saved the Revolution, by David A. Clary. And from the Pew Charitable Trusts, sponsoring Philadelphia's new audio walking tours called Sound About Philly at soundaboutphilly.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Turkish novelist Elif Shafak. She was recently tried under Article 301 of the Penal Code for denigrating Turkishness in her new novel. A newspaper editor recently convicted under Article 301 was assassinated last month. Now many Turkish intellectuals and writers find their safety threatened. Join us for the next Fresh Air.